Good afternoon and welcome on in to Kildare Focus. You're listening to Kildare's KFM. It's Wednesday, the 18th of October. Caoimhe Harney here with you until 3. Coming up first on today's show, we'll be speaking to Danielle McLaughlin, Policy and Communications Officer at Ruama. There's a 35% increase in demand for services by victims of human trafficking and sexual exploitation. At 2:20, Brendan O'Shea, Newbridge GP, will talk to us about seasonal adult depression, or SAD as it is known, because of course it's getting dark and the days are getting shorter now. And then lastly, we'll speak to Dr. Grace McCormack, Senior Lecturer at NUI Galway. The native black honeybee is in decline amid a swarm of imports. And of course, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can phone in 045-898-999. You can email me to studio@kfmradio.com, or of course you can send us in a WhatsApp or a text. Also today on the show, I have a Lily O'Brien's hamper to give away, so do stay tuned and keep listening, and I will tell you how you can win that fabulous prize before I eat it.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, Ruama, a charity that supports women impacted by human trafficking and sexual exploitation, has seen a 35% increase in demands for services. I'm joined on the line now by Danielle McLaughlin. She's Policy and Communications Officer at Ruama. Good afternoon, Danielle.
Good afternoon, Caoimhe.
Danielle, your new annual report published yesterday, it's quite shocking and very stark figures coming out from that.
Yes, it's been a very, very busy year for Ruama in terms of the numbers of individuals presenting to service for support. Our organisation is based in Dublin, but with hubs in Midlands, and a new service opened in Limerick at the end of last year. And we have expanded our services in terms of increased capacity in our trauma and counselling services. Our education development programme, our Bridge to Work programme. We have extensively expanded on the training that we provide to frontline services and professionals who may come into contact with service users or with individuals impacted by sexual exploitation. And that's really to reach those hard-to-reach cohorts of individuals who are isolated and may not be able to find out about the supports, may be isolated in terms of their being controlled, and they may not have adequate supports, and may come to the attention of health professionals, the guards, GPs, for example. So we've massive extent. We increased our training by 50% last year, and that's increasing. But what's stark about our figures last year, we worked with 497 individuals last year, majority women, and the majority were women from different countries of work. But we identified 46 different nationalities. So that was an increase of 35% on the previous year.
Okay. 224 of whom were new referrals last year. When people come to Ruama, do they know about Ruama before they come to you, or, you know, are they usually brought by someone else trying to help them?
So we're really working on that to try and get the word out there among people in frontline services. So we're reaching out, providing in-reach services to direct provision accommodation around the country, homeless services, addiction services, domestic violence, refuges. We work with the Gardaí providing training, and we are in close contact with the HSE and the Women's Health Service, and it's often their service and the guards who would make referrals to us where they've been identified. And have agreed to seek some support. But what we're trying to do is reach more frontline workers in different areas that might be able to learn more about how to identify a victim and signs that someone's been trafficked. Often a person might not even be able to identify the fact that they have been trafficked themselves and won't have heard of that concept. and they have been manipulated to the point that they understand that it's a choice. So we're working with those individuals who've been impacted by prostitution by kind of lack of a choice, and are pushed in by different issues like poverty, death, addiction, homelessness. And then we're working with individuals who have been trafficked, and often the case is that they've been trafficked in another country and then brought to Ireland. And this is a cross-border issue across the island of Ireland, across Northern Ireland as well. It's a very hidden issue in society, and a lot of the work that we're doing is also to raise public awareness as well, so that people might be more aware that women are in the country who are at risk, and who are possibly being impacted by sexual exploitation.
Do you think, from obviously these figures, you know, that the situation is getting worse, that Ruhama has a big task ahead of them?
We're certainly, one of our findings of our report, a key finding, I suppose, from 2022 is that the demand for sexual services has increased, as we're seeing more vulnerable women being put in danger. And we know that the demand was still quite high even during the pandemic when people were restricted. So we know that we're perhaps just seeing the tip of the iceberg in terms of people who can be identified and who are seeking support. We know there are people out there who are still trapped, and the guards are doing their best, but what we've been advocating for, and indeed the guards and the government are in support of this, is a reformed version of the legislation to empower the guards with more resources and capacity to arrest, to prosecute, to impose sentences, and additionally for the mechanism that identifies victims of trafficking specifically. So there's a lot of work going on in that area, in the policy and legislation, and we're starting to see, hopefully by the end of the year, that being implemented. There's a lot of work going on in the background to try and tackle this.
Okay, some people may have watched the Primetime programme last night. I dipped into it. Danielle, I didn't see the whole thing, but I did see Erica, one of the women. I know it was a pseudonym given to her, but you know, she spoke about having to flee her country, and she had four daughters. She was promised a job in the UK, brought into Northern Ireland, and then a man, you know, reached out to her and basically got her help and brought her to the Republic, where she came to Ruhama. For people who are, you know, out and about in everyday life, how would you spot the signs maybe of someone who potentially may have been trafficked? Because it's a, you know, if you're in a supermarket and you see something fishy or you see something strange, it would be hard for someone to approach that person or know what to do in that situation without maybe making it worse.
Absolutely, and people can help without taking a risk of intervening. People can raise a suspicion to the guards, and the guards will act on that, they'll investigate. I'll give you a good example of that. That happened some months ago, where a woman had raised suspicions with the guards that there may have been a brothel nearby. I think it was around Drogheda. And she had alerted the guards because punters, these sex buyers, had been actually arriving at her door instead of the brothel's door, and had noticed that women, you know, several different women were coming and going from that one property with suitcases, and different women had showed up at different times. So the suspicions were raised, the Gardaí investigated and uncovered a brothel, made arrests, and had actually been able to save individuals who were victims of human trafficking. So there's a lot that people can look out for in terms of individuals who look like they're being kind of transported around with suitcases by one individual man, That's one example. There's many, but, you know, yeah. some suspicious activity like that, or individuals with very little English. And a lot of this, these details will be in our training, and that's the kind of thing that we're trying to put out there, and that people can actually participate in saving the lives, really, of victims of trafficking. Mm. And in many cases, it is happening. But it is very, very difficult to locate brothels as traffickers are moving women from county to county for 1-2 weeks at a time. And a lot of the advertisement for, you know, sexual services that they claim to provide is being offered online.
Okay.
And so the way that they escape, they evade kind of detection from the guards is by moving the woman around and, you know, not having any form of identification, taking their identification off them. And they'll often not have access to phones. Even if they do, they're being threatened, or their family's being threatened back in their home country. So there's a lot of control going on there. And we know that a lot of prostitution and human trafficking is organised by organised crime groups.
Okay. In terms of the women who are trafficked, Danielle, with children, does Ruwama, you know, support families, support women with children maybe who have been brought here unbeknownst to themselves? What way does Ruwama work in terms of support and help when people do reach out for support?
Certainly, we definitely work with women who have children that can be children who are born here, or children who were, you know, in their home country being looked after by family members in the hope that their mother was, immigrating for a better life and earning money to send back to support them, but ended up trapped in prostitution. Based on a false promise of a job, but the services that we offer, we are aware that there are some women who do have children, some will go through the international protection system in order to be able to access family unification for to allow them to apply for their family to join them in Ireland. And that is a big, major process for them, particularly if they are working through the trauma following the impact of prostitution and being forced and trafficked. So we're working with them, with our caseworkers, on practical supports, on access to support, and advocating for, you know, access to education, to training, to jobs, to childcare support, to schools. So there's a lot of one-to-one practical support, and then there's a lot of emotional support. And as I said, we offer trauma therapy and counselling as well.
Okay, I have one message in here, Danielle. I'm concerned about a local woman in my area. Should I contact the guards or Ruwama?
If that individual, I'm saying she, could be he, it could be very genuine concerns, and I think for their peace of mind, absolutely contact the guards. The guards are working, and they have a dedicated protective service, National Protective Services, and they have Gardaí dedicated to investigating suspicious cases, and do you actually call for the public to alert them on these things, because as I said, it's extremely hard to identify this. Yes, I would.
And just for anyone who would like the Ruwama helpline or the number, it's 01836-0292. That's 01836-0292. And Danielle McLaughlin, Policy and Communications Officer at Ruwama. Thanks very much, Danielle, for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Now, an airline boss has apologised for posting a photo of himself topless and getting a massage during a work meeting. Tony Fernandez is the founder of Air Asia, shared the image on LinkedIn. However, it was removed a few days later after a wave of criticism. One user called it gross and said it impacts work ethics. I don't know if it impacts work ethics, but it's not really very appropriate to be posting pictures of yourself getting a massage. But anyhow, obviously he thought it was the right thing to do, but no longer there now. But If you want to go over to the Irish Examiner, it'll show you the more things change. Headlines from 50 years ago mirror recent news. So the front page then shows the Cork Examiner, and it's the front page of the Cork Examiner, which is obviously now the Irish Examiner, from July 26th, 1973. And the headline is, "New Wave of Price Rises Coming." Sounds familiar anyway. Bank staffs reject pay offer is another one. And prices, body allows 1p on petrol, but CIE fares stay. So yeah, sounds fairly similar to things that are going on here at the moment. The budget, rising prices and war in the Middle East, of course, making headlines today. But 50 years ago, similar topics were making the front page, with the CSO issuing a release charting the changes in Ireland from 1973 to 2023. They have taken a look on the Irish Examiner at some of the headlines making news 50 years ago. So the Irish Examiner, or the Cork Examiner, of course, as it was known in 73, features a number of stories that would not be put out of place on today's newsstands. So if we look at another page, it says, "Budget with sting in its tail." That's another headline from the 17th of May, 1973. Sounds very familiar as well. So if you want to head on over there and have a look at that, there's very good, interesting pieces on it. But the CSO issued their figures today, and the average price of a house in 1973 was €9,000. The average price of a house now is €318,000. And if you were to compare €9,000 to what it would be in today's money, it would be around €50,000. For any would-be house buyers out there, or people trying to get on the property ladder, it's a little bit hard to take, I think. But there you go, €9,000 in 1973 to buy a house. God, I wish I was in those days. Jennifer Page, Crush, here on Kildare's KFM. Now, of course, I did say earlier on in the programme that I have a Lily O'Brien's hamper to give away today. And I was thinking, you know, what way would I do the competition? What will I say? And I want people to text in some stories. So how addicted to chocolate are you? You know, what have you done? What lengths have you gone to get your hands on some chocolate? And I'll tell you my own personal story. A couple of years back, 10 plus years back now, I was down in my cousin's house. I was having a cup of tea, lovely tea, drinking away, but they had no chocolate. There was nothing in the house. And she said, "Look, you're grand, sure you don't need it." And I said, no, I do need it. My parents were gone on holidays. I was driving my father's pickup truck, my pickup, and I hopped in the car, drove up the road, went into my house, got the chocolate, drove back down the road, swung into the driveway, crashed into a fence, drove the Jeep into a tree, and rode off the Jeep. So that's what happened to me when I was trying to get a bit of chocolate. 0833 97 97 97. Give me a bit of a laugh this afternoon. Give me your name and your location in the county, and I will announce the winner of the hamper at the end of the show.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, it's around about that time of year where some people may be experiencing seasonal affective disorder. It's similar to normal depression, but it happens at a particular type of year, usually at the start of autumn or coming into winter. Well, luckily, I'm joined on the line now by Newbridge GP, Dr. Brendan O'Shea. Good afternoon, Brendan.
Hi, Caoimhe. Good afternoon.
Brendan, tell us about SAD. Some people might not be familiar with it.
Well, I mean, there is a seasonality to general practice, and at the beginning of the summer, the hay fever crowd are in.
Okay.
And certainly around this time of the year, you certainly will have a couple more people coming in feeling quite down in the dumps. SAD has been around, it's been understood for quite a while, for one or two decades. So it really is a thing. And it's affective, seasonal affective. Affective is a synonym for emotional, and your emotional state consistently drops down. So I suppose one of the questions is who gets it. Another one is how do you know you might have it? And another question might be when do you need to do something about it? This is the time of the year. less daylight certainly plays a part in it. And some of the therapies that have been tried and have had studies done on them related to giving people extra doses of light artificially, which all sounds very elaborate and finicky. But certainly less daylight is part of it. The cold is almost certainly part of it. For some of us who are a little bit older and we've got a bit of mileage in our joints, most osteoarthritis and any kind of arthritis really is more bothersome in cold, damp weather. There's strong evidence for that. So it's cold, it's a bit miserable, the joints are a bit achy. We're heading into a winter. These are all factors that weigh on people's mind and can cause them to become drift into an emotionally negative state.
Okay. What symptoms should people be looking out for then if they, you know, maybe they are suffering from SAD?
Well, I suppose a key feature of it becoming a depression is a persistence of symptoms, typically for more than 2 weeks, a feeling of low mood, and that can reflect itself then. If your mood is low, you can fall behind on things. So if you're falling behind on jobs, which when you're well, you just motor through, but when you're a bit depressed, they become monumental and it gets hard and the house, you know, the housework can get on top of you. You can get behind on your to-do lists. More severe spectrum, emotional ability, so bursting out crying really, for no good reason repeatedly. Something sad on TV, you have some sad thoughts, or your relationships with the people around you gets difficult, cause you to become weepy. More severe spectrum again, if you begin to start having thoughts of doing any harm to yourself. So any or all of those are relevant, and especially, I mean, we're all allowed to have bad days, we're even allowed to have a bad week, but if it's going on for more than 2 weeks and interfering with your activity of daily living, it's absolutely time to do a reach out and do something different.
Okay, when you say do a reach out, Brendan, what can people do if they think they're suffering from SAD?
Well, look, I hope they're listening to this programme, because the more you understand about it, the better position you are to deal with it. Read up a little bit about it. Patient.co.uk is a very generic NHS website. It's excellent for all good medical queries. So don't Google seasonal affective disorders. Go to a decent website. Patient.co.uk is a good one. Get out. Okay, so this is the Irish winter we're grappling with, and it's not, it doesn't rain persistently from the end of September until June. So be on the lookout when the weather is fine, wrap up and get out and go. Exercise puts a bit of bounce back in your emotions. Getting out into natural daylight is felt to be helpful emotionally. Getting out into natural daylight is felt to be healthy in terms of maintaining a good sleep pattern later on that night when you go to bed. And again, persistent wakefulness is another feature of seasonal affective disorder. But probably the single most important thing is social connectedness. And for people who are living alone, and if you know somebody who's living alone, or for older people, this is a tougher time. So reach out. And for ourselves, engagement in social activities is there's huge evidence that that's really important. You mightn't feel like it, but make that effort to get out. You know, go out to the parish centre, go out and drink in moderation with your friend in a safe manner, go to the movies, just make it your business to connect, meet people for a coffee.
Okay. Brendan, people who suffer from seasonal affective disorder, does it go away once the good weather comes back?
Well, it is what it says in the tin. It's seasonal, and this is the time, and it's the miserable weather and less daylight are probably contributory to it.
Okay. Would go on medication for seasonal affective disorder, or would it be advised?
It's good. It's nice to see it in practice, because very often the lifestyle advice, taking an interest in the person, defining a fairly simple plan with an exercise prescription. Another thing that can happen is as part of the misery, people can drink a little bit more. And these are all subtle things that all add to the feeling of depression. So a conversation and a very straightforward plan, people often do very well with that, and particularly if you schedule a review after 6 or 8 weeks to see how it's going. That all creates a feeling that somebody somewhere is taking an interest. And a lot of the time with straightforward seasonal affective disorder, that approach works very well. But sometimes there is a need to use medication, and sometimes there is a need to use more formal psychotherapy, depending on the individual. Certainly people who have an underlying diagnosis of any depressive illness, they will find this time of the year more difficult. So, and don't leave it all to healthcare professionals. Do the community thing, do the family thing, do the friend thing. Who do you know who might be grappling with this? And what can you do? Ring them up, take them out.
Okay. Brendan, these lamps that you sometimes see advertised, are they a fad or do they work?
The evidence is that they are weakly beneficial, as in they have a small benefit. We always ask ourselves, what's the cost of any of these things and how easy are they to put in place? For me personally, sitting in front of a lamp comes very much in second place to wrapping up and getting out in the curragh, or getting up on the bike, or getting out and saying hello to people.
Okay, so you wouldn't necessarily advise the lamps?
I wouldn't be rushing off. There are other things I do first.
Okay, okay. Any last tips then, Brendan, if people are listening in and maybe bells are ringing in their head saying, I think this is me?
Well done for listening and not switching off, and understand that you're absolutely not on your own, that it is tough heading into the winter. It's tough for people who are very busy and maybe too busy. It's tough for people who are on their own. It's tough for older people. So let's do it all together. Be interested in each other, you know, and do the retail thing.
Okay. Newbridge GP Brendan O'Shea, thank you very much, Dr. Brendan, for joining us this afternoon, as always.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney.
Well, keep your messages coming in, 0833 97 97 97. Lots and lots of stories in regards to the hamper. So I have Rose texting in here to say, this happened in my house, was given a box with 12 bars of chocolate in it, put it into a press, forgot about it, till one day about 2 weeks later I said I would have one of the bars, pulled out the box, nothing in it, only a piece of wood. My husband had ate them all. The very nice Rose. Yeah, your husband now. I'd have to have words with my husband if he was doing that. This is a story from Dunn's Stores. I think it's coming in from Magella in Athy. Colonel's Court was 24 hours. We were doing a marathon of Christmas movies with my nieces who were home from Dubai. We all loaded into the car and drove to buy selection boxes. Yeah, the 24-hour stores are great for that kind of thing. Now here we have another one here from Rob Dunn in Robertstown. Stop at Robertstown, sit on a bench and eat my drifter while I went into a deep sleep. While eating away, I heard a crunching sound. I looked behind me and my car was rolling down the hill. I ran after the car, opening the door to pull the handbrake up, and the door caught against the curb and folded back on itself. My son had woken up and stood on the handbrake while getting into the front seat. Not only did he do all the damage to the door, but shortly after it happened, drifters were taken off the market. We'll never forgive my son. That's from Rob Dunn. Rob, that sounds like a very serious situation there, all because of some chocolate. Another one here, Bridget O'Rourke, went up to a local shop, nicked some chocolate, went home and ate it. An hour later, police were at the door. They had the wrong address. Was worth it. Okay, Bridget. People are going to get in trouble. Sinead and Salen says, hey Caoimhe, so for health reasons I've recently started to making gluten and dairy free choices. I went to Tesco and did a massive shop for snacks about 2 weeks ago. I saw dairy free, gluten free and egg free chocolate muffins and I was so excited all day, literally saved it up for after my dinner, and I can honestly say it was the worst thing I've ever tasted. My body might have appreciated the alternative, but my taste buds didn't. Think I deserved the proper chocolate after the whole ordeal. Traumatised. Yeah, and Sinead, the way I think about it, Sinead and Salen's there, thanks for that message. If you're going to have chocolate, just have the full fat. Like, if you're going to have, like, if I drink Coke, I just have the normal Coke. None of this diet stuff, because, like, you might as well have full sugar if you're going to have something like that. Keep your messages coming in, 0833 97 97 97. Very stiff competition for the Lily O'Brien's hamper to give away today. If you want to be in with a chance to win, send me the most ridiculous thing you've done to get your hands on some chocolate. We've very serious chocolate addicts across the county, it seems. Now, the native black honeybee is actually in decline in Ireland because of imports that are coming into this country. The Irish species is actually not protected under national legislation. Well, to tell us more about this, I'm joined by Dr. Grace McCormack, Senior Lecturer at NUI Galway. Good afternoon, Dr. McCormack.
Good afternoon. How are you? Thanks for having us on.
Delighted to have you on. Tell us first about the Irish species and then, you know, the different imports that are coming in and the effects.
So firstly, a slight correction. It's a subspecies. So okay. We have Apis mellifera is the western honeybee. And in Ireland, we have a subspecies called Apis mellifera mellifera, which is a dark bee. And that is a subspecies that is distributed across northern Europe. So we have, in the last 100 years, people have started to bring in bees from Italy and Eastern Europe, and these are other subspecies. And because they have been separated from our Irish subspecies for thousands of years, you know, across the mountain ranges, separating them. But what happens is that when they're brought in, they never meet naturally in Ireland, because the black bee arrived in Ireland after the last ice age and has been isolated since then and has adapted in Ireland to our climate and our weather and our environmental conditions here. Okay. And they wouldn't normally meet these other bees. So beekeepers are bringing in these other subspecies because of different traits. And there's also been some bees being artificially made by mating these different subspecies. And one of them is buckfast. And buckfast is a very popular bee for beekeepers because it's very quiet, easily managed. And so beekeepers have been breeding and bringing in these other bees, which because they are the same species but would never normally meet, they can interbreed with our bee.
Okay. And they're interbreeding at the moment, and that means then what? That the native black honeybee is dying out, so to say?
So at the moment, we're very lucky in Ireland. You know, in Ireland, we've had this bee. The work that my student did and with collaborators in UL, we looked at bees back in around 2014, and we found that like fewer than 5% of the bees that we sampled were non-native bees. So there was a really, really positive story there, because there was a significant population of our native bee. The numbers of imports of bees have increased tenfold since 2012 to 2021. And beekeepers have started to see a much higher increase of what we call coloured bees in their bees, in their colonies. And so we did some work. Wild bees are a very good kind of representation of what's in our population. And what we found is that the numbers of hybrid bees has gone up by tenfold to match that.
Okay.
So
does that matter, you know, to the does it have a huge effect, like, on the day-to-day things in our ecosystem?
So the thing is that our bees have adapted to live in Ireland. So in Ireland, the Italian bees can't survive the winter in Ireland. They can't. They try to breed all the time, and they're not used to dealing with our damp, wet weather. They can't go out to mate in our damp, wet weather. Whereas our bees have adapted to that, and they have adapted behavioural traits that allow them to overcome these problems. So if we get hybridisation, if we lose, what happens is when bees interbreed and come in, we lose these traits. So basically the genetics, we get these hybrids that may not have the traits that our bees have. And if we end up with just kind of a mongrelized population of bees in Europe, then we lose all of these distinctive traits that allow the bees to adapt in their local area. So bees have a very, very close association with their environment. They rely on the environment totally. So if we disrupt it if we just left our bees that we have here, and if beekeepers looked, just selected their local bees and kept with their local bees, then we're actually supporting the bees that have adapted to that environment. If we keep bringing in bees that are not adapted for our environment, but are adapted to warmer, drier conditions, then we might end up with the bee that always has to be minded by beekeepers, always has to be imported every single year, that won't survive our winter and it end up actually costing the apiculture industry, I think, an awful lot of money. Mm. But we lose biodiversity. We have our Irish hare, right? We have our red squirrel. We have these kind of populations that are unique to particular areas, and they're really valuable. Biodiversity is so valuable, and we're losing it at such a rapid rate. So if we lose the traits in our native Irish bee because we're just not thinking, and all of a sudden we end up with a hybridized population and we've lost these important traits that allow our queens to go out and mate in the middle of a bad July, then we're in trouble.
Okay, what do you think the solution is then? Do you think it needs to be put into legislation that beekeepers can't be bringing in these different types of bees?
So bees have this awful situation because they're both wild and they're considered to be domesticated. They're not domesticated. We don't control their feed and we don't control their mating. However, they do come under the remit of the Department of Agriculture, Food and Marine. They are a tradable species. So the government have to be very careful. They can't be embarrassed in Europe, you know, bringing in laws to ban trade. It might, you know, they have to consider that angle. So the government are being very careful about this. We did bring, you know, I suppose there was a collection of people, the Native Irish Honeybee Society, the Climate Bar Association, Senator Vincent Martin brought a bill to the Senate in October 2021. It's gone through three stages and it's halted at the moment because the government think we need more evidence to show what is the impact of continued imports if we don't ban imports, and also are there other things that we can do to mitigate it. I mean, so we have a bit of work to do to show that, but ultimately, what I know about in other places in Europe, Ireland is unique. We have still a very large population of wild and managed native honeybees. The horse has bolted in all other European countries, actually. Ireland is the last stronghold of this subspecies. So we have a duty of care from a wildlife perspective to protect this biodiversity, whatever about the domestic animal situation. So elsewhere, nothing apart from a government ban has worked. So really, really, ultimately, probably we would need government intervention to really protect this species. But we have a body of work to do to show the government that that's the case. And that's where we're at the moment. So you can understand, but really, I can understand the government's position that they have to be very careful about bringing in law. But at the same time, we would like to invoke the precautionary principle in one sense that, you know, we should do it in case we lose it.
Okay.
So other people haven't acted fast enough and they've lost that biodiversity. Ireland has a chance. And actually, other countries in Europe are looking to Ireland. We're leading the way in terms of studying. We have a wild population of dark bees that beekeepers are using also for stock. Other countries in Europe don't have these wild populations because they have to kill them because of hybridization and disease and all sorts. We have this. So other countries will be looking to Ireland for I suppose, to mine this subspecies and in order if they want to actually reinstigate this bee in other places.
Okay.
So I do think I'm really worried. You know, we published a paper a couple of weeks ago that showed this big rise in hybridization, and I nearly died when I saw it because they were in our wild bees, and I couldn't believe it. We're in the middle of another large study where we're genotyping 500 colonies, looking at their morphology and everything to see if the situation is the same. So far, we're looking at the same type of situation. Okay. So what I'd be asking in the meantime is that beekeepers, don't buy your bees online. Look to your local beekeeping association and try and get nooks and bees from your local association or local beekeepers. The Native Irish Honeybee Society have a whole list of people that supply queens, Native Irish honeybee queens. And also the Native Irish Honeybee Society have new queen rearing program going on now where they're helping local associations rear native queens. So I would ask local associations to drive it home to beginners, to not be in such a hurry to buy bees, to take their time and make sure that the bees they buy are local bees or from a reputable breeder of native Irish honeybees.
Okay.
That's what I would say.
Dr. Grace McCormack, Senior Lecturer in NUI Galway. I'll have to leave it there because I'm tight on time. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.